Are you looking for ways to attract and retain private pay clients? Thrizer is a payment platform for therapists built to help clients automatically tap into their out-of-network benefits and save on therapy up front. Check out our special link, join.thrizer.com/modern therapist, and use the code modernTherapists to activate $2,500 in free payments with Thrizer.
Simplified SEO Consulting has DIY done with you training and done for you SEO options. So there is truly something to fit every practice owner's SEO needs. Check them out at simplifiedseoconsulting.com/modern therapist and use the code modern therapist for a DIY course or mention the Modern Therapist Survival Guide podcast during your consult for special offers.
You're listening to the Modern Therapist Survival Guide, where therapists live, breathe, and practice as human beings. To support you as a whole person and a therapist, here are your hosts, Kurt Widhelm and Katie Vernoy.
Welcome back, Modern Therapists. This is the Modern Therapist Survival Guide. I'm Kurt Widhelm with Katie Vernoy, and this is the podcast for therapists about all the things that we do. And we have pretty big milestone coming up in our profession here, where the DSM-5 is transforming into the DSM-5-TR. And we are joined today by one of the very instrumental people behind the updates to this, Dr. Michael First. He's professor of psychiatry at Columbia University and editor and co-chair of the DSM-5-TR, talking to us about some of the exciting updates that are happening and a little bit of the process behind it. So thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. First.
Great. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're so excited to have you and to have this conversation. We had reached out to our audience for some questions, so we'll try to get to some of those. But our first question that we ask all of our guests is, who are you and what are you putting out into the world?
Okay, so I have a position at Columbia University. I also work at the New York State Psychiatric Institute, and I also have a private practice in New York City and also a forensic practice. So it's pretty busy. But my main thing through my life has been DSM. I actually got involved all the way back at the last year of DSM-3R in 1986, because I did my residency at Columbia, where Robert Spitzer, who is the king or whatever of the DSM, he created the DSM, he put it on the map. So I got to work with him, and I've been working with him and also with the person who did DSM-4, Alan Francis. And so I've had my finger in some way, shape, or form every DSM all the way up. And I also work on the ICD-11. The WHO has their own classification, and they're just recently updated theirs as well. So I also worked on that project.
Wow, that's awesome.
So some of us have been practicing a while. My grad school, we were on the DSM-4-TR, so I got to see through the transition of DSM-5, but can you maybe provide a little bit of context for what's the goal of a text revision as opposed to a full update and looking at, you know, just kind of jumping into the next number here?
Let me give you background of how the 4TR came about. There was no 3TR, for example. The 4TR was the first TR. So it's all started way back in 1980 with DSM-3, which was the first version that had diagnostic criteria. When they were working on it, they had this idea that it was just something that psychiatrists would be interested in. But when they published it, it became this huge hit. You know, it sold millions of copies. Yeah. It really transformed the field. People found it very, very useful. And so 7 years later, they did the DSM-3R. Now, why that wasn't called DSM-4 is simply because the DSMs are actually linked to the ICD. And ICD-10 was supposed to be coming out in 1992 or so. And here we were in 1987. Today, they said, well, actually, this is an in-between DSM-3 and DSM-4 revision. So that's why it was called the 3R. And then DSM-4 comes out in 1994. And then after DSM-4 came out, there was a lot of pushback in the field about APA grinding out a new DSM every 7 years. Everybody had to learn it. So things really put the brakes on the DSM. So APA made a decision that we're not going to 7 years from now do a DSM-5. We're going to wait and see. But what the downside of doing that is the text, which is 90-something percent of the book is actually text, not just the criteria. The text is a really good resource for mental health professionals about diagnosis and prevalence. It doesn't have anything about treatment, but it's kind of like a super textbook in the sense that it's got the top people in the world working on it. They kept waiting to do DSM-5, which was clearly going to be at least 10 years, if not more, away, ended up being closer to 20 years. The text would have gotten very stale. So that was the motivation to do the DSM-4TR. When they did the 4TR, they made the decision so people wouldn't be, you know, bent out of shape about yet another DSM to only do revise the text. The diagnostic criteria were going to be unchanged. It turned out there are four very, very small changes because there were a couple of errors that had been found in the DSM-4. Like, for example, Tourette's, tic disorders, had a requirement that in order to diagnose somebody with Tourette's, it had to cause clinically significant impairment and distress. That's a standard DSM phrase. So you're trying to differentiate things that aren't problems from things that are problems. The neurologist got all bent out of shape about that. Tick's a tick. Whether or not it causes the impairment, it's still a tick. So we deleted that criteria. But it was very small stuff like that. So that's why the TR really was just a text revision. So DSM-5 didn't come out until 2013. So when DSM-5 came out, it was a complete redo of all the criteria and the text. And then moving forward, what happened was, is the DSM-5 TR now. Now, DSM-5 TR is actually different than the 4 TR because it is this time the criteria have changed. There have been changes to the criteria. And the way that was accomplished was the fact that we now have, the APA has a process in place to allow changes to be made on an ongoing basis. And that was one of the reasons why the DSM-4 criteria weren't changed, was every time they do a revision, it's a huge, expensive, you know, hundreds of people involved process. And, you know, because you really want to, every time there's a change, you want to make sure the change has been well-researched, you consider the pros and cons. So it's a big process. So they realized that moving forward, the APA realized that now that we're not stuck using just books, they could actually have changes made in the DSM on an ongoing basis. And that's what happened. Since DSM-5 came out in 2013, there have been a number of changes in the criteria set. So the criteria sets in the 5TR, about 70 of them, have some changes. Most of them are very, very minor, you know, correcting tiny, you know, errors, but there's some that are significant. So one of the differences, of course, is that for when 4TR came out, you could say, I don't want to buy that. I mean, you can still say that about 5TR, but you could say, I care about the criteria. I'm making diagnoses. I don't really need to see the text. That's not true this time. The actual definitions have changed. There's a new disorder in the DSM-5TR. So we've added a disorder. It's prolonged grief disorder. So it's much more clinically relevant, the DSM-5TR, really, than the 4TR was.
What are the big important changes that we should know about in DSM-5TR?
I'd say the biggest is prolonged grief disorder. So, you know, whenever a new disorder is added to DSM, that's big news. I mean, sure. Having gone through many, many DSMs, the press always cares, what's the new disorder? So this is a new disorder. Now, this disorder has been researched now for a number of years. I mean, the concept of prolonged grief disorder is really a hole in the diagnostic system. So there are individuals who, after losing a loved one, normally you basically adjust at some point. I mean, it's always painful maybe to think about the loved one, but you move on with your life. And that's a very important part of the grieving process. There are individuals where they're unable to do that. They're basically stuck in a grief reaction month after month. So after a year has elapsed and the person's grieving and preoccupied with grieving, then you could meet the criteria for prolonged grief disorder. So it can't even be given until at least a year has elapsed. And these were individuals, a number of individuals who had that problem, and it was really unrecognized and wasn't in the system at all. Now, when DSM-5 came out, it was a research appendix in the back. So when DSM-5 was in preparation, we already knew about this condition, and there was some controversy about how best to define it. So they actually put something in the research appendix called persistent complex bereavement disorder in the back. That is the precursor to what's now called prolonged grief disorder. So it's been around. But so now, after this, we finally got to the point where we felt that the research was clear enough, the case was compelling enough that it would do more harm than good to put it in there. And it went through all the processes within the APA for approval, and it was approved and added to the online version. And now it's in the hard copy version as well. So that's by far the biggest change. Probably the next biggest change has to do with suicide. Now, suicide, if you look at the DSM now, suicide is basically a criterion in major depressive episodes, criterion number 9. That's like the biggest. Suicide, of course, as a therapist, is one of the most important things that we have to deal with. Very, very important. But the DSM has it as a little sidelight, so to speak. So we felt it was very important for therapists and clinicians and researchers to have a way to indicate the presence of suicidal behavior independent of depression. You know, suicidal behavior can occur in a wide variety of mental disorders, including no mental disorder at all. So we wanted to have a way to indicate that. So it turns out that there's a mechanism within the ICD-10, which is the coding system. You know, everybody knows when you write down the diagnostic code, you get paid. That's not a DSM code. That's a code from the International Classification of Disease, which is a government controlled system. We realized that there are these things called symptom codes in the ICD-10, which are not disorders, but they allow you to list a particular symptom that is of particular importance. So we actually went and requested from the NCHS, the National Center for Health Statistics, to have a new code created for suicidal behavior, current and history of suicidal behavior, and also current non-suicidal self-injury and history of non-suicidal self-injury. So there's 4 separate codes that are now in the book that will allow you, it's optional, obviously, to list those along with the diagnosis. So if you have somebody with major depressive disorder who's suicidal, you would list both major depressive disorder as a diagnosis, and then we also list this special code in addition. That's the really nice addition. The rest are not quite. So one of them is there's a category that's been added, actually restored, called unspecified mood disorder. And what's that? So why is that a big deal? It turns out that, you know, when you first see somebody who has a mixture of mood symptoms, you know, you have to write, you know, one of the things about getting paid is you need every time you see the patient or client, you need to write down a diagnosis which reflects what the person looked like during that meeting. So let's say you have your first meeting with a client and they have this, you know, mix of irritability and agitation and a little sad. What would you call that? And you say, well, you know, I'm going to have to look into, maybe I'll check their history more, speak to some other, you know, previous treaters. We've got to write something down. So what the DSM does in general, when you see someone and you don't know what the diagnosis is yet, either because it doesn't fit into any of the diagnoses or because you simply don't have enough information, that's where these unspecified codes come from. So like typically, if you see somebody who is psychotic and either you don't have enough time to figure out what diagnosis it is, or there simply doesn't fit in, the type of psychosis doesn't fit into any diagnosis, you would write down psychotic disorder unspecified. So for mood, there is bipolar disorder unspecified and depressive disorder unspecified. The question is, that person who is agitated and irritable, what is it? What would you call that? And there's some implication there. If you wrote down bipolar disorder unspecified, then in their record, their medical record, the rest of their life will be something that says bipolar disorder, when in fact, this may simply, you know, morph into a case of major depressive disorder, because irritability and agitation is commonly seen in depression. So the real, what we had to do is we introduced a new unspecified category that allows you to be neutral about whether it's bipolar or depression. So that's why it's called unspecified mood disorder. What you use that, you're saying, you know, I don't know what it is. And I know it's a mood problem because the symptom is a mood symptom, but I'm not going to commit myself to say whether it's either depressive or bipolar. So it's a new parking place, so to speak, to put your client before you figure out what's going on in a way that's going to be less stigmatized.
I think that's great.
Then there's a couple of corrections to problems in the criteria sets. One of the ones is autism spectrum disorder. So autism spectrum disorder, if you'll recall, and when we went from DSM-4 to 5, that was a new category that was created. It used to be autistic disorder and Asperger's disorder. There were several different, and PDDS, or different types of autism disorders. For DSM-5, they decided to consider the entire thing a spectrum of conditions. So it's now autism spectrum disorder, and it comes at 3 levels of severity. So autism spectrum disorder is defined, there are 2 clusters of symptoms. There's the social interaction, social engagement, awkward social, you know, reading social cues piece of autism. And then there's this preoccupation with unusual interests or repeating words. So there's 2, you know, separate dimensions of autism. the autism spectrum sort of criteria set was reformulated, and we had to come up with a new algorithm. Now, the challenge here is autism spectrum disorder is really had a huge amount of interest in the past 10, 15 years because of what appears to be this explosion in cases of autism spectrum disorder. And part of that is been argued that it's people are recognizing it more, and that's why there's more cases. But part of it is over-recognizing. Anyone that's like kind of a little weird and awkward, oh, they're on the spectrum. That's become a very common phrase. You know, in the English language now, if you watch movies and TV, you start hearing about, oh, that guy's on the spectrum. So it's become incorporated into language, but it also shows that it's being overused and overdiagnosed. So when the diagnostic criteria sets, the prevalence often depends upon how you construct the criteria set. So when you have a criteria set, for example, that says 5 out of 10, if you were to make the requirement 3 out of 10, the prevalence would go up a lot. If you were to go up to 8 out of 10, you would shrink the prevalence. So those kinds of criteria that give you a number out of a larger number has a big effect on prevalence. So when they reformulated the autism criteria set, they wanted to make sure that the new criteria set was conservative. The way it works is there are three items for the social impairment piece of it and four of the restricted interest problem. The restricted interest is 2 out of 4. The social one was supposed to be 3 out of 3. But if you look at the criteria itself, it just says including the following. It wasn't clear if you had to have all of the following or any of the following or whatever. It was intended to be all of the following because they were very worried about not inflating the rates of autism spectrum disorder. So the new version now has in very clearly all of the following. So that I think was a good, I don't know how many people were making that error, but certainly it was there to be made and you know, opened up to different interpretations. I think those are some of the bigger ones. There's lots of small tinkering arounds, but I think those are probably the most ones of the greatest clinical interest.
Thrizer is a payment platform designed for out-of-network therapy. As a therapist, you would use Thrizer to charge clients for sessions and collect your full rate upfront. From the client's perspective, Thrizer links to their health plan, so insurance claims are automatically submitted for them upon every charge. From there, Thrizer manages the claims end-to-end so that your clients don't have to worry about manually submitting super bills or getting on calls with insurance. The best part? Thrizer allows clients to only pay their co-insurance portion for sessions, while Thrizer covers the rest of your fee and waits for reimbursement on their behalf.
They also offer you an instant benefits calculator for free, allowing you to provide upfront transparency to prospective clients on their out-of-network coverage. Therapists only pay a standard 3% credit card processing fee per session with no additional fees. Visit join.thrizer.com/modern therapist to get started and use our promo code Modern Therapists to receive $2,500 in waived fees for your sessions.
We received a lot of listener feedback and some specific questions as far as some diagnostics that may not be appearing and specifically some things like complex PTSD, developmental trauma disorder, orthorexia. Can you explain to our audience a little bit here as far as what your process is for inclusion or further research into maybe an inclusion of these in the future? If these are things that are being discussed with the APA and kind of how the decision is made as far as what do we include? What do we kind of continue to just monitor and see what's out there?
So this is another a change in process. So when the DSM-5 was done over, however, 8 years, they had all these committees and they would look what's out there in the literature and people would write in suggestions. So there was a whole process during the DSM-5 to make lots of major, major changes. Those committees don't exist anymore. Instead, there's a steering committee. And what the steering committee does is we entertain proposals for new disorders. So the prolonged grief disorder, even though it was in the appendix, somebody had to come and propose that it be added to DSM-5. But when you put together the proposal, there's on the DSM portal, there's a whole complicated, they give an indication of what kind of empirical information is required. You want some evidence of validity, reliability, want to make cost-benefit analysis, is the harm versus the advantages balanced in the right direction. So there's some hurdles to go through to get one of these things in there, and the website lays out what those hurdles are. So now the the system is more reacting to what people suggest rather than coming up with diagnoses on our own. So it's a little bit of a change. So that's now the process. All the changes you've just mentioned so far were suggested and then ultimately approved. But let's cover some of the ones you mentioned. So right now, there's really no, unless somebody were to write in and say, I want complex PTSD in there, it's not going to be considered unless somebody actually outside the system proposes it and makes a formal proposal. Now, complex PTSD is interesting because the ICD-11, I mentioned in the beginning that I worked on the ICD-11, has complex PTSD. They have both PTSD and complex PTSD in ICD-11. So they made the decision to include that condition. Now, the DSM, it turns out that the DSM version of PTSD, if you compare it to the ICD PTSD and complex PTSD, there are elements in the complex PTSD. Much of that has been incorporated into the criteria set for PTSD. So it's kind of a little blurry. What's not emphasized is it typically when complex PTSD was first proposed, it was a type of PTSD that happened in response to chronic early traumatic experiences, often ongoing. That was the original concept. But it turns out, and this is from the ICD-11, if you look at the ICD-11 definition, even though they say that's often the kind of trauma that causes complex PTSD, that's not required. That what defines complex PTSD, at least in the ICD, it's like PTSD plus some chronic changes in the person, just sort of a chronic sense of disconnection, chronic inability to, social impairments. They've basically been changed. The trauma is so extensive, it's almost like changed them as a person. So you have that more typical symptoms of PTSD, like re-experiencing and avoiding things, plus these more fundamental differences in the person. Now, some of those complex PTSD symptoms are now in the PTSD criteria set. So that's what I meant by saying that we sort of took some of the complex and added it to the regular one. So here's an example where, and there are a number of examples where the ICD-11 and the DSM-5 differ. And that's one of them. DSM-5 decided to have a single PTSD category that was a little bit more broad, where ICD-11 decided that they wanted to have two. I've heard some other proposals, but a lot of these proposals that have been floating around haven't really reached the stage of enough empirical research really to be able to be seriously considered for the DSM. They're potentially good ideas, but none of them have been offered as actual proposals with proposed evidence to be able to be evaluated. But any of those, if somebody, and if you're any people listening, want to make such a proposal, you go to what you can do that. There's a website, which is easy, www.dsm5.org. If you go to that website, that's the DSM website. On the front page, you'll see it tells you how you can make a proposal and what you need to do to fill out the application.
It seems like what you're describing is a process to really allow a feedback loop to the steering committee. And you also described the DSM as being, because it's electronic, being a little bit more dynamic in being able to pick these things up. What is the likelihood that one of these diagnoses, assuming they've got the empirical research attached, might end up in the next DSM? Like is that...
Well, see, that's how there is no next DSM for the time being. I mean, it could go in. If somebody were to write a proposal today for complex PTSD and arguing that the current PTSD isn't covering a very important group of patients, that these are the kinds of things you would, kind of argument you could make for something like that would include things like the fact that that diagnosis doesn't exist is hurting people because people are not recognizing it. So, the reason it's hurting them is the treatment for complex PTSD would be different than regular PTSD. That's another part of the compelling case. Another part of the argument is that you need to show that it's somehow distinct from regular PTSD and distinct from other conditions like adjustment disorder or this new prolonged grief disorder. So those are the kinds of things you would need to do to make a convincing case. And then you would submit it. And if it goes through the whole process and it was approved, it would now go into the DSM. The hard copy version, of course, it's not, if you buy it, it's not in your version you bought, but the electronic version, it will go into there. So we're in a funny transition now where you have the hard copy version and the electronic version living side by side. And therefore, if you buy the hard copy version, you're not it's not as easy to see the ongoing changes. But APA considers what's approved and in the electronic version to be the official DSM. And the hard copy, like the one that's going on sale now, is a snapshot of where the electronic version looked like, you know, looks like now. So everything that's in the electronic version is now in the hard copy version. But as things happen, if somebody were to get complex PTSD in there and it gets in there before the next hard copy version comes out, then you'll have the situation where it's only on the electronic version and not in the hard copy version. But it's, since it's on the electronic version, you could use it. You know, it doesn't have to be in the hard copy version to be a legitimate diagnosis to make on one of your clients.
That's decided it. I'm not buying a new copy then. I'm just going to get the electronic version.
Sure.
So when you're looking at the research that's submitted, what kind of thresholds are you looking at here? It sounds like part of this is not only the criteria that's maybe showing up in people's offices, but also some of the ways that things are being treated as some of the factors that you look at in how things are included, how things are ruled out or kind of kept under some of the existing diagnostics that are there. But what are you really looking for in the research that people are proposing?
Well, there's no one thing. I mean, I personally, I'm a clinical utility person. So I, to me, the most compelling thing is making a case that this is going to help people and not hurt them. I mean, that personally, but that's not sufficient. I mean, you can make a proposal that that's the case, but if, because there's two things. One is to say this is a good category to put in there, and then it's how to define it. That's a big problem. I mean, lots of concepts are out there, but what would be the criteria set, for example, for complex PTSD that actually is a distinct group and wouldn't by accident include people who don't have complex PTSD? So the technical thing is the case for complex PTSD is, like, let's look at what happened with prolonged grief disorder. There's a perfect, so that's already happened. How did that get in there? Well, patients were out there that people were noticing that didn't fit in any of the DSM categories. And they clearly were suffering. So they had some kind of mental disorder. They didn't have, I guess a lot of people say, oh, well, they have major depression. That's not major depression. You can have major depression and prolonged grief disorder, but they're not the same at all. There's hardly any overlap. So there's a big hole in the system that allows people to come into your office and not have any place for them. So that's the first piece of it. Then another compelling thing about prolonged grief disorder is there's a psychotherapy that has specifically been developed. It's a variation on a CBT for treating prolonged grief disorder that's been successful. So that's another compelling reason. Not only are you calling it something, but you have something to offer your clients by saying, well, this is the recommended treatment. So that's a kind of argument, you know, the DSM. It's very, there's been, especially since DSM-4, in fact, there was a paper that came out before DSM-4 came out called Holding the Line on Diagnostic Proliferation. It was very, it used to be very easy. It sounded like a good idea. It would go into the DSM. There are a couple of problems with that. Once a category gets into the DSM, it's very, very, very hard to get it out. There've been very few diagnoses which have been deleted because there's always some constituency who says, you will ruin my practice if you get rid of this diagnosis. So that's why knowing that it's easy to get in, easier, to get in than to get pulled out, you really want to make sure that things that are in the DSM won't need to be pulled out because you've too hastily added them. So I think there's been kind of a much more conservative view about putting categories in the DSM nowadays than there were back in, you know, 20, 30 years ago.
We also got some questions, and we've had some conversations actually recently about diagnostic criteria that potentially needs to be adapted to fit a more diverse population or an understanding of the diversity in our population. I'm just curious how culture, other demographic differences, all the things, how those things have been addressed in the text revision, but also kind of the concept around how you're making sure that the criteria, the descriptions, all of the pieces really align with a very diverse population that we live in.
That's a great question. In fact, there's been major efforts since DSM-4. There was a special committee starting with DSM-4 for culture-related issues, how disorders present differently in different cultures. Now, the criteria sets are hypothetically supposed to be vanilla that apply across all cultures. The way you deal with cultural variations in the text, there's one section called culture-related features. If you look at the content of that text, it's very specific that in this population, it may look like this. So it's trying to show how that variability is taken into account. But that's an opportunity to let me tell you about a very important thing that we did with the TR that was basically, it's very interesting. It was during the development of TR, George Floyd happened, and our entire consciousness about systemic racism became sort of raised. And the question was, are there things in the DSM that are reflective of this kind of systemic racism? So we actually created a committee that went through the entire DSM looking for, systemic racism is the most extreme case, but things that were not quite nuanced enough. Like very often, one of the big problems, of course, is like, what is race anyway? But that is because you're an African American, are you really different than other people? And if you are different, like very often in the DSM, in the prevalence section, we'll say, if we break it down by ethnic group, we'll say, depression in Blacks is this and in Latinos is this. The question is, why is it different? Is it because biological reasons among these groups? Is that why it's different? Is it different life experiences? There's huge amount of data that the disadvantaged social settings for some of these groups is the reason why they're different, not something essential about being Black or Latino. So that was one of the things when they went through the whole book, they were looking to avoid giving a message that something about the race itself is what's causing it to happen. So the way they dealt with it is if they have a statement that says it's this in Blacks and this, and an extra sentence that says this difference is likely due to differential exposure to racism, things like that. So it was a very, very thoughtful way of trying to make it clear and de-emphasize and also get rid of stigmatizing statements. So the whole book went through that thing. And that was really triggered by the awareness that was not originally part of the original plan of the TR. It was the fact that happened during the process. A new committee was convened during the process. I'm glad that we had enough time. It was early enough in the process that we were able to get it in the DSM-5 TR. I was a little dubious, but they worked really, really hard, that committee, to be able to go through everything that's in the text revision to make sure it worked for cross culture and also making certain minorities stigmatized.
Simplified SEO Consulting's team of mental health professionals genuinely want to help you attract more of your ideal clients with a proven on-page SEO process using the strategies that are most effective for therapist websites. They know SEO is an investment, which is why it is so important to find someone who aligns with your values and understands the importance of building your private practice in a meaningful way. Simplified SEO Consulting hopes to be that team for you and your practice.
The expert team would love to talk with you during a free consultation to figure out the best fit for your SEO journey. Simplified SEO Consulting has DIY, done with you training, and done for you SEO options. So there's truly something to fit every practice owner's SEO needs. Be sure to ask if their innovative content network is a good fit for your website. Listeners of this podcast can get 20% off a DIY SEO course with code MODERNTHERAPIST or mention the Modern Therapist Survival Guide podcast during your free consultation for $100 off your done-for-you SEO program onboarding this spring.
Check them out at simplifiedseoconsulting.com/modern-therapist. Were any of the diagnoses assessed in that way and determining whether those diagnoses were appropriate across all the different demographic considerations? The one that comes to mind specifically, we recently had a discussion on trans mental health, and gender dysphoria is one that kind of is this requirement to be able to kind of move forward with some of the things for transition. And it was interesting, the conversation was like, well, I'm not dysphoric. It's socially, kind of... everyone around me is dysphoric about my gender. I'm not. And I have to kind of go through this process of saying that I'm dysphoric in order to get the letter that I need for the hormones or whatever. Were there or are there plans to look at kind of the impact of diagnoses or how diagnoses are put together and the impact on folks that are in typically marginalized populations?
Well, cultural, I think trans is a special case. I could get to that the whole issue of should trans even be in the DSM. I mean, lots of people in the trans community don't consider it a mental disorder. So that's about to get to that. But in general, we do consider that. Like conduct disorder is a good example. About a lot of the items in conduct disorder in minority populations living in high crime area, it's normal. It's like adaptive to do some of the things in the conduct disorder criteria sets. And we don't want to give people who are trying to adapt to their difficult environment a diagnosis simply because in a different population, in an advantage suburban population, that item would be evidence of pathology. So again, the text for conduct disorder has things in there. And the criteria sets get adjusted to drop items that might be overly influenced by a culture and not apply to other cultures. Now, trans is a different story. So let me get into that. So and the name is also changed. DSM-5 is now called gender dysphoria. It used to be gender identity disorder. That's what it was up to DSM-5. So they actually changed it from gender identity disorder to gender dysphoria to make it less stigmatizing. It was felt that saying there was something wrong with your identity, there's a disorder in your identity, was much more stigmatizing than saying that you're upset or it's creating a dysphoria. The fact that the term used in the ICD for this condition is gender incongruence, which is a very well descriptive term. It's the sense that your assigned gender and your experienced gender are incongruent. So the problem is this. So the individual that said, well, I'm not dysphoric, I agree. You could say that they shouldn't get any mental disorder, but there's a big problem. How do you get qualified for treatment? Unfortunately, we live in a country, there's lots of things that are very harmful, like, you know, marital strife, child abuse. You can't get paid. If you put a code for marital relationship problem on your billing form and submit it, nobody's going to cover it because the insurance companies and the government have made a decision, unwise in my perspective, but that's not my call, to not include cover things that are not just so they're really like insurance. The way they look at it is insurance is for medical conditions. That's the basic concept. We're not gonna, for example, if you want to get plastic surgery to make yourself look better, it'll make you feel better. Their government says we're not going to cover that because that's sort of a cosmetic thing. Even though it makes you feel better, you're not treating a disorder to have a nose job, for example. There's a whole bunch of things that the government doesn't want to cover. Unfortunately, basically, in the ICD, everything that is outside of the disorder section, you won't get covered for. Now, gender dysphoria is in the mental disorder section. Therefore, you could qualify for treatment. If they were to remove it from the DSM entirely, then you would never be able to, the insurance companies wouldn't, not to say the insurance companies are happy about covering it, but they would really have a weapon to say, well, if it's on the DSM, we have no obligation to cover it. So what happened in the ICD-11, which I told just came out, they had the same problem, but they had a different solution. The ICD-11 is all of medicine, not just mental disorders. So they had the option of moving gender incongruence out of the mental disorder section and moving it somewhere else so that it could still get paid for. And where did they move it? They created a new chapter called Conditions of Sexual Health or something like that. And therefore, they were able to put it there. And now it's a condition that could get paid for. The United States, which is still using, so that's ICD-11. The United States is still using ICD-10. So there's no place in ICD-10 to move it. So that's why we're kind of frozen in the situation of it continuing to be in the DSM in that spot for very utilitarian reasons. I mean, I'll give you another case. Somebody who, I actually heard this case, a person had sex reassignment surgery and took it off as a tax deduction under the health thing. They were challenged by the IRS. They said, oh no, sex reassignment surgery is a cosmetic procedure that you can't take a deduction for. That's their attitude. And you know, it's very tricky because again, they don't want to cover things. So it's a balance. Yes, it's stigmatizing, but on balance, is it better to deal with the stigma by virtue of its placement in the DSM or not have the services covered anymore? We're kind of stuck. There's some talk about moving it maybe to a different spot in the DSM to try to help with that, but the code is still the code and the code is still a mental disorder code. So until the ICD code actually changes, it's going to be a mental disorder and we don't have any control over that. That's the government.
Sounds really complex.
So if I can kind of synthesize down some of the important points that I'm hearing here is in this process, you've taken some of the criticisms from the field of the DSM and made it more inclusive as far as feedback opportunities for professionals. It's not, you know, committees hidden away in dark rooms, you know, twirling their mustaches and, you know, running their fingers and just, you know, being the arbiters of mental health diagnostics. But one of the major things that I want to emphasize that you've brought up here a couple of times is that there's a lot of parts of the DSM that are not just the diagnostic list that people should read from time to time. And I think that outside of maybe some of the psychopathology classes that grad students have to go through, we sometimes forget that. And that a lot of the information that we do bring up in our conversations, that the text part, this is the major emphasis of the text revision here, is go and read these parts. And it probably answers a lot of the questions and criticisms that we have from the field. And now, more so than ever, it's had an opportunity for a lot more people to at least make suggestions, and that feedback is being looked at.
I can't agree with you more. The criteria are pretty bare bones. So,
yeah,
you know, on their own, there's lots of, you could discuss, argue about what particular one means. That's what the text is there for. The text allows you to explain what they are. How do you assess it? I mean, as I said, the text is like 99% of the words in the DSM, and the criteria maybe 1% or less. So the text is extremely important. That's why we did the text revision. The difference from the last one is we didn't just leave it to the text. We also have the criteria, but you're absolutely right. Many of these things we dealt with, like this whole thing about systemic racism. If you look at the criteria set, there's nothing in the criteria in the TR that would indicate that we did anything having to do with our sensitivity to race. That's all in the text.
So to that point, I wanted to check in on a couple of things, because it seems like there's an opportunity for anyone anywhere who's able to do some research, make the case, they can submit to the committee. But I'm curious about who's at the table, who's on the steering committee, and are you including folks that, is there a diverse population of folks there? Are there people with lived experience that are giving feedback? Like, how are you making sure that there's enough folks at the table to make sure that you continue this process of assessing how you're not managing just, not even just culture, but also the lived experience of being autistic or other areas of neurodiversity, that there are folks who have psychotic symptoms that are weighing in on some of these things and what the presentations, those things. I mean, it seems like there's such a huge opportunity to have a lot of perspectives. How are you navigating that internally with the steering committee?
Well, the steering committee is very small. And most okay. people on the steering committee are the women on the steering committee, and there are people who are African American, but it's still relative. And obviously, just because there's one African American and a few women, that doesn't mean all perspectives are covered. We realize
sure,
that, but it's not simply a bunch of white guys, you know, making the decisions here.
Got it.
Where do we get those other perspectives? Well, the way we've tried to deal with that is, when something gets, like, let's go to prolonged grief disorder as a good example. That category was controversial because there are a number of people who felt that you're calling people who are having normal grief, you're calling them having a disorder. There's a lot of pushback against that category. So what we did is, before somebody gets into the final DSM and approved, it gets posted on the DSM-5 website for 45 days. It's open for comment. We get lots of comments. And that's really the opportunity for people with a lived experience to say, you know, you clearly didn't take into account this aspect of it. I live with this and you didn't get it. So the committee would read all of that. If they make a good case, then they could change it. Absolutely. So that's the way. I mean, being on this tiny group of people who make the decisions, unfortunately, there's a limit to how diverse we can make, because there are not that many people. But there are many layers. I mean, even within the American Psychiatric Association, it's got to be approved by this thing called the APA Assembly, which is sort of like Congress, so to speak, with lots of diversity built into that. And then, so there's so many different levels of approval. That's where some of the diversity comes in. And could it all, could we make it more? Maybe. But that's what we were able to do.
Well, it seems like there's also an opportunity to reach out to diagnostic communities when a new diagnosis is being presented, to make sure that you're getting some of that feedback. It seems like there's mechanisms in place. My hope is that there's also efforts to connect with folks with lived experience or those elements, so that people can really be ready to take on that 45-day period.
Right. That's an interesting question. How do we do our best to publicize it? Anyway, but you're right. It'd be great if, in fact, we've done that before. I think in this particular case with prolonged grief disorder, I think there are organizations, patient groups, we could go to them and say, like we made a change in the psychotic section. There are clearly individuals with lots of lived experience and NAMI and, those kinds of groups. So there have not been any changes, recently that would affect that. But that would be obviously something we would want to do, is to go make sure that they're aware that the change is there and give them an opportunity to give their feedback.
Where can people find out more about you and your work?
I have a website at Columbia. I'm on the faculty of Columbia, so every faculty member gets a website. I happen to have a Wikipedia page, so you could look at that. My email, I don't keep my email address a secret. That's one thing. I mean, it's very interesting to me working on this. If I have to contact an expert, to get their email address could be incredibly difficult. You type their name in and you type an email, it's nowhere. You have to... I don't know why people are so afraid to have their email address public, but mine has been public. It's been public the entire time I've been in the field. And I'm happy for people to let me know what they think.
And we'll drop Dr. First's email in our show notes. You can check that out over at mtsgpodcast.com. And we'll include links to a couple of other episodes where we've had some relevant guests in the past talking about things like prolonged grief disorder and some of the other things that we've done. And follow us on our social media. Until next time, I'm Kurt Widhelm with Katie Vernoy and Dr. Michael First. Remember to check out Thrizer. They are passionate about making out-of-network therapy work for everyone. Clients save upfront on therapy while therapists earn their full rate. Get started in minutes on join.thrizer.com/modern therapist and use the promo code Modern Therapists and receive $2,500 in waived fees for your sessions.
Don't forget, we have some special offers from our partner, Simplified SEO Consulting. Get 20% off a DIY SEO course with the code Modern Therapist, or mention the Modern Therapist Survival Guide podcast during your free consultation for $100 off of your onboarding to the Done For You SEO program. Check them out at simplifiedseoconsulting.com/modern therapist.
Thank you for listening to the Modern Therapist Survival Guide. Learn more about who we are and what we do at mtsgpodcast.com. You can also join us on Facebook and Twitter. And please don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any of our episodes.